Good morning on the eve of Sukkah. Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those of you who are open to the idea that every human institution, religious, political, media, military, economic, are rotten to the core, counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed, and that we should not be in alliance with them or loyal to them. And also for those who are open to the realization that there is a higher calling, there is an opportunity, there is something and someone who is reliable, upon whom you can depend. That would be Yahweh, a name that is unfamiliar to 99.99% of the world's population. He is by job description, however, quite famous. He's the creator of the universe. He's the author of life. He is also the inspiration behind the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Good morning. It is a Monday morning this particular year, Sukkah. Now, some of you may have celebrated it beginning last night. Others of you will celebrate it beginning this evening. I'm a beginning of this evening Sukkah celebrator. It is the 15th day of the 7th month. Now, the moon cycles are 29 days, meaning that from the essentially a new moon to a full moon would be 14 and a half days on average. Last night was a total lunar eclipse. Lunar eclipses only occur on full moons. So, if you view, as I do, the first day of the month as the light is beginning to renew itself over the surface of the moon, that was Teruah, meaning that Sukkah, which is to camp out with God, would begin the evening, on average, after a full moon. The moon is still relatively full, of course, but as the moon is just beginning to wane. Sukkah is one of my very favorite holidays. It will be the holiday that we will celebrate for all eternity. But more on that, a quick announcement. My life in terms of locale changed not all that long ago when we decided that we didn't want to be bi-coastal anymore, when both of our sons had left California. Both went to college, graduate school in California. And both moved our eldest to the Ohio area, where he is an aeronautical engineer, and the youngest to Texas, where he is a biochemist. And we then decided that we would sell our home in California, which we did, many of you know. And during this process, within days of the time that the home was in escrow in California, we learned that our eldest son's wife was pregnant. Well, we are, as many of you know who have been listening to this program, we're approaching the eviction date for our first grandchild. Tomorrow was going to be eviction day, because she would be fully 1 week late, and that's as far as OBGYNs want this all to go these days. But this morning, about 10 minutes ago, my daughter-in-law's water broke, so she is on the way to the hospital, and will be delivering a baby girl here within, well, whatever number of hours it takes for her to go from beginning to end of labor. So this is a celebratory time for us, and obviously the birth of a child, our first grandchild, takes precedence over most everything else that we do and celebrate in life. So this program is being brought to you by an almost grandfather, and by this time tomorrow, it will be brought to you by an old codger who is officially a grandfather. Normally, in the first hour of the program, we begin with news, and I'm sorry for the I was going to say sorry for the indulgence in my own personal life as opposed to the news this hour, but most of you who listen to the program celebrate family, because that is really why the universe exists. It's why life exists. Yahweh wants to celebrate family, and so the whole concept of children and family and husbands and wives and mothers and fathers and homes and households and all of these kinds of things are near and dear to him and central to his message to us. But this is a day, because it is the eve of Sukkah, and Sukkah is an 8-day long celebration, we are going to turn our attention to Sukkah. Now, it's called Tabernacles. Some call it tents, others call it booths. It's interesting that it's given those titles. Most common title, I think, for Sukkah, which is Yahweh's title, is Tabernacles. The rabbinic title for it is booths, which is kind of an odd concept. The name itself, which we will examine here in great detail in a moment, is suggestive of a protective covering. It is a temporary residence, and it is these two things meld together with the recognition that Sukkah is a temporary home pitched to protect and cover its inhabitants and to shield them from the environment outside. It's a place for family. And so there's a lot to this, particularly the concept of pitching a tent to camp out. And so my favorite, I would say, means of translating Sukkah would be camping out with God. Just simply camping out. So it's called by all of these names. It is the seventh Mikra. It follows the pattern that Yahweh has of all things. 6 + 1 equals the desired result. It's a simple formula. Man, who was created on the sixth day, is representative of the number 6 plus God, who is one, equals God's idea of a good time, God's reason for creating the universe in the first place. So it's 6, man, in addition to God, is God's idea of the perfect and ideal optimum result. It is not only the answer, it's the right answer. We did a series of programs, both in Shattering Myths and on Yada Yada Radio, about how, given the choice between being good and being right, I'd vastly, overwhelmingly prefer to be right. God can make me perfect in his eyes, even if I'm not good. But if I'm not right with him, if my conclusions regarding what he's offering, if my responses to him are not right, then doesn't matter how good I am, there is no chance of engaging in a relationship with him. And so when you consider what all of this represents, it is important that we are right with in regards to what this day represents. And Sukkah is the right answer. It is the answer that is correct according to God. It means that the first 6 steps that we take to God, the first of which begins with a doorway, a portal to life eternal, Pesach. The second is the threshold. It would be the welcome mat. It is the means of us cleansing us, wiping our feet, if you will, of the rubbish of religion and politics and rebellion against God, so that we are perfected and therefore can enter his home in the most promising, the most loving, the most welcoming, the most empowering, the most ennobling way possible, as children adopted into the family of God Almighty. That occurs on Bukkurim. It is the third step along this way. The fourth step is the result of being adopted into the Almighty's Bereth, a covenant. and that is that on Shavuot, which is the promise of seven, it's a celebration of the Shabbat. It is God's promise to his children. We are enriched and empowered. Collectively, these first four steps to God fulfill all of the benefits, enable all of the benefits of the covenant. To be made immortal, to be made perfect, to be adopted into Yahweh's family, to be enriched and to be empowered as a result. This then leads to the fifth step along the way. This family is the only means to eternal life with God. It's the only means to heaven. It's the only way to have a relationship with God. All other paths lead to either one's demise or to their eternal carceration in Sheol. Therefore, on Teruah, Yahweh's children, the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, Bukkotim, and Shavuah, share Yahweh's testimony. We proclaim a warning to those who are political and religious and militaristic that those paths lead to death and destruction. And at the same time, we herald Yahweh's message that he has a path that leads to him, that he has a covenant of which there are five terms and conditions, as well as five benefits. Teruah is all about blowing one's mortal breath into the instrument of salvation, a ram's horn, and out of it comes Ruach, the spirit, air, with nefesh being breath and Ruach being air, a wind instrument. And this then leads, for those that pay attention to that call, who respond to that call on Teruah, it leads to reconciliation, Yom Kippurim, the day that we celebrated just 5 days ago. Reconciliations is primarily focused, and its fulfillment will be with Yahudim, and particularly with Yahuda and with Yisrael, and collectively then their relationship with Yahweh. That is the plan. And Yahweh will fulfill it in year 4000 Yah in 2033. It's a year that we learned a great deal about as many of us looked at the full moon. Not only the full moon, but a blood moon eclipse of a supermoon last night. It will occur again in 2033. Sukkah, camping out with God, is actually our reward and his. It is the summation of Yahweh's purpose. We, as members of the covenant, are offered the opportunity to camp out with God in the ultimate universe. Not only this one for a number of years, about 1,000 of them yet to come, but also in a new one that he's actually going to create in our presence. Sounds like fun, doesn't it, Kirk?
Sounds like great fun to me.
Yeah, can you imagine actually being a witness to creation?
Well, you know, I can tell you I can, but I can't.
Yeah, but you know, think about it. You'll be the artist on hand to capture the moment.
I'll bring my sketchbook. I'll be ready.
What if, and the reason he's creating a new universe is for his pleasure and ours, you know, for us to enjoy the whole process, the calculation, the thought, you know, and make contributions to it. But what if he turns to you just before he creates the universe and he says, you got your sketch pad and pencil handy? This is the last time I'm going to do this, Kirk.
Get it right this time. Well, my hands will move a lot faster than they do now, so have a shot at it, you know.
Oh, that'll be funny. Yeah, I guess, though, because we will essentially be light where time exists, and we'll be in the seventh dimension, and my guess is that he will once again create a sixth-dimensional universe with us witnessing it from the seventh dimension, that under that basis, we ought to be able to witness creation so often that you probably, you know, as often as you want, you'll have a chance, yeah, to go back and try it again if you don't get it right the first time.
Yeah, I'll get my white out. I'll be ready.
Now, an artist of your caliber doesn't use whiteout.
I'll never confess.
Okay.
The less you know, the better.
Well, it is interesting, too, that the summation of these seven meetings is a tent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tent is not a a flamboyant abode, is it?
No, it's a very temporary dwelling.
Yeah, and it's portable too. You can take it wherever you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it signifies the nature of Yahweh. You know, when he was in the wilderness with his children, when he's leading them to the promised land, his abode was the tabernacle of the witness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a tent. You know, a tent.
Right.
You know, here's the creator of the universe.
Spectacular, isn't it?
He's got a tent. You know, the wannabe gods of Egypt had mighty pyramids. You know, the gods of the mighty wannabe gods of Greek had the Parthenon sitting there high on a hill. You know, and the Romans would build these massive temples wherever they go to their pretend gods.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pretend gods have all of this pretense. Where the real God is, you know, I'm really quite content with a tent.
Yeah.
And the result of the seven Mikra is a tent.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I looked up those words, too. They were really quite amazing. I read your commentary again yesterday, and because we were celebrating last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up sukkah and then a root word and also chog just to remind myself that a feast is a feast as opposed to the English type of translations of what they try to turn it into.
Yeah. Chog, which is the descriptive term of sukkah, describing this camping out with God, is a festival feast. But more on that in a moment. Just think just for a moment about the fact that, A, the creator of the universe was content with and specifically desired a tent, not a... You know, an edifice built out of stone, not with carved in things all around it.
Not even a Vatican City.
Right. No, yeah, we don't need any obelisks. We don't need any temples or basilicas or shrines. The tent will be just fine, thank you. It shows that he is humble and approachable. Very little separates us from him. And the second, a tent is wholly and completely portable. And in the universe, do you want to stay put all the time and just chit-chat, or would you want to go off and explore? What's more fun?
The concept of sitting on a cloud playing a harp is not really exciting to me.
Yeah. We have Glenn who has called in. And Glenn, are you going to make fun of me for being old, or are you in the process of preparing to celebrate?
And congratulations, you good
thank you.
Grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. This is... I'm a huge celebratory fan of children and life and home and you know everything that Yahweh designed us around so that we could celebrate. So this time of being a grandpa for the first time, oh boy, I'm excited. It's interesting with Sukkah. It's just like the first of the seven set apart invitations to meet with God with. With Pesach, there was a dress rehearsal and a fulfillment. With Sukkah, there was a dress rehearsal and a fulfillment. Do you fellows know what the dress rehearsal was for Pesach?
Pesach, of course, is Abraham and Yitzhak going up the mountain.
Abraham and Yitzhak going up Mount Moriah. Yahweh. Saying, no, I will provide the sacrifice, and that your son, Yitzhak, shall live, because he was going to provide the sacrifice. And so that's the dress rehearsal. In fact, it occurred exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years before 2033, which was the enactment of Pesach, where Yosha, the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, became the ultimate sacrificial lamb, fulfilling the promise of Pesach on Mount Moriah. Same place, exactly 2,000 years later. So we go from year 2,000 Yah to year 4,000 Yah. How about Sukkah? Do you think there was a dress rehearsal for it?
Well, tabernacle in the wilderness.
Yeah. the tabernacle in the wilderness is a dress rehearsal for it. Yahweh camping out with his children. But so is, in all likelihood, we are indirectly told, but all of the elements are there. Yosha became the child who was born to us, and the son that was given to us on tabernacles. Mm-hmm. And so he, Yahweh, camped out with humankind for 33 years, beginning in what was on our pagan calendars, the fall of 2 BCE on tabernacles. There was no year zero, which means that he was still 33. 30 when he began his celebration of his ministry, and 33 when he was cut down, but not for himself, on Mount Moriah's pole. So there was a dress rehearsal pointing to it. But let's just say that you could come up with a date in 2 BCE for tabernacles, and I'm unable to. All of NASA's means to date moon cycles begin in year 1 CE. So I'm not able to tell you what the 15th day of the 7th month was in 2 BCE. And I think that's a good thing. And I've never really pressed it. Maybe there's some other site that you could go to other than NASA's site to be able to ascertain when it was. I don't think it's a good thing. Let's just say that we figured out that it was this year it's the 28th and therefore 29th of, because Sukkah will be all the day of the 29th, depending on when you viewed the first sliver of the moon's light in the seventh month. But let's just use this evening and the 29th. Let's just say that it was on September 29th of 2 BCE.
Okay.
Would there be a reason to celebrate September 29th, therefore going forward?
No, it's not. Oh, because it's a lunar calendar.
That's right.
It'll also be a pagan holiday type of thing for us.
You're right. It's the date on our calendar is meaningless. What's meaningful is it's the 15th day of the 7th month. It is Sukkah. Yahweh camped out with us on the day that he has designated for us to camp out with him. Where does Yahweh instruct Israelites to camp out? It's around Jerusalem. Where were Mary and Miriam and Joseph? Suburb of Jerusalem, doing the right thing. They were celebrating tabernacles. That's why they were camping out there. They went there to camp out. So yeah, it's
just being known by so many people in so many history books, because I knew this long before I read yada yada, and I used to debate it all the time with fellow Christians. At that time, I was still a Christian, and I would say, well, he cannot be born in December 25th.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to celebrate him. I don't know why you do, but if you do, and it was always outlawed in the first, in Massachusetts for the first 100 years of this country, and just didn't do it. So why are you celebrating that and pretending when it's very plain that it was not his birthday anyway? He would have had to come in the fall, 6 months after the birth of John, the Mercer.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Why are you doing this? Because back in the day, back in the time of the religious calendars of the Romans and of the Greeks that influenced this region, December 25th was the winter solstice. That was the day that all pagans, that was the second most important day on the pagan calendar. It was the day that the days began growing longer. So it marked from a sun god worship, the birth of the son of the sun, because the days became longer from that point. They stopped shrinking in duration and became longer. The daylight hours became longer starting December 25th. So it was always the son of the sun. In fact, one of the early church fathers talks about how fortuitous it was that the Christian celebration of Christmas happened to fall on the winter solstice, when the son of the sun was born in all of the religions of Rome and of Greece.
Wow, what an amazing coincidence.
What an amazing coincidence. Yeah, we orchestrated it that way, and yes, so therefore it's a coincidence. Go ahead.
The other thing that's more twisted is Easter, Ishtar. It's celebrated on the first Sunday after the first ecclesiastical full moon after the vernal equinox. Talk about astronomical, astrological idiocy.
So long as it doesn't fall on Passover, which under that occasion is pushed back a week, because we wouldn't want it to fall on that dreaded Jewish holiday, now would we? No, and of course, the reason for that, for the celebration of Ishtar, of Easter, is that, A, the sun, and in terms of days, we've reached the equinox, the spring equinox, where the length of the day and night hours are exactly the same. So it's called the equinox. And therefore, at the equinox, it was assumed in the pagan religious lore that the sun impregnated Mother Earth. That's why you get the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, and the birth of the Babylonian religion, where you have your trinity of gods, where the son, the chief god, the father, impregnated the mother, Mother Earth, or the wife of the king, whichever it might happen to be at the time. And so that 9 months later, guess what is 9 months after the spring equinox?
The winter solstice?
There we go. That's when you would have the birth of the son of the sun. It was all based totally and completely on sun god religions. And, of course, what day of the week is Easter always celebrated?
Sunday.
Sunday, right, to honor all sun gods. The fact of the matter is that, A, Yahweh was not born. God was not born. Yahusha was not born. You know, you read Yahshua, it's really clear. A child was born unto us, a son was given. A child was born. But the thing that made that child divine was the set-apart spirit. And therefore, it's a child or the son of Yahweh, a representative of Yahweh, one who comes in the Father's name and is doing the Father's business, was given to us on this day. God was not born. He does not want you to celebrate his birthday. And that would be a terrible corruption of the purpose of Sukkah, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose of Sukkah, that we're given the opportunity to camp out with the Creator of the universe. The Creator of the universe wants to camp out with us. Not a birthday celebration.
You know, what's interesting, atheists, when, you know, apologetically refuting Christianity, are quick to pick on the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, you know, for Yahusha, because, you know,
they're different.
Because not only do they differ, but it also would seem impertinent because, you know, Joseph's DNA wasn't involved, and, you know, the genealogy chase traced down to Joseph. And for Jews, the actual maternal lineage is more important than the genealogy is for Miriam. And, you know, so this is, and it's my personal take is, you know, when a baby's conceived, you have, haploid DNA strand from male, haploid DNA strand from the female. It's my speculation that Yahweh created all the DNA for Yahusha's body. I don't even think he used DNA from an ovum of Mary. But this gets really impertinent, though, pretty quickly.
What is pertinent, however, is that when you are reading Matanyah's account, Matanyah, I am certain, did the best he could and tried to walk us through the lineage. And for the most part, my guess is that he is accurate. Yep. But there is nothing in Matanyahu that says, I'm inspired.
Right.
So and what I do is I use Matanyahu for a singular purpose. I think that so long as I can, or we can, take what was Hebrew conversations that were originally recorded by an eyewitness, Matanyahu, in Hebrew, and then were changed by a scribe 100 years later that did not know Hebrew very well, into Greek, and we can recast that conversation back into the native tongue, Hebrew. And so long as we just look at Yosha's words from a Hebrew perspective, then I think that Matanyahu has tremendous value. But when you're reading just Matanyahu's words, I think they are of lesser value. But they're still of greater value than anything that Luke would have written, because there is no indication whatsoever that Luke was ever a member of the covenant. There's no indication whatsoever that Luke ever attended Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, or Shavuah. And he most certainly wasn't an eyewitness. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is a wonderful time of celebration, a realization that we get to camp out with God, that we get to live with Him. And to when you compare that to the idiocy of the pagan adaptation of Easter and Christmas, it just must make God want to cry. You imagine that. Here, you know, like we had the Pope of the largest Christian, the head of the largest Christian religious sect, and he's here celebrating Sunday. And yet, we stayed one more day, he could have celebrated Sukkah. If he had paid any attention to it, rather than giving an address to Congress, he could have celebrated Yom Kippurim. Didn't even mention those days. And that's that.
It's extraordinarily.
And, you know, God's pretty clear about it. If you don't celebrate Yom Kippurim, you don't answer His invitation to meet with Him on Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations.
It's over.
It's over. You know, I think part of the reason it's over is what Yom Kippurim represents. It's the ultimate reconciliation and affirmation of Yahweh's covenant relationship with the descendants of Abraham, with Yisrael, and with Yahudah, according to Yahweh's testimony, whereby He's returning to fulfill Yom Kippurim in year 6,000. Yeah. It's it, man. You know, if you don't make up your mind by that time, if you don't get it right at that moment, it's over. So if you don't answer this invitation, there are no second chances. I think that's the reason it's written that way.
Well, Sukkah's celebration when you're already covered. I mean, you already got the set apart spirit's light over you. So if you don't make Yom Kippurim, you miss the light and you miss the party.
I mean, you miss the party. Exactly. So you looked up the words chag and sukkah, and what did you find when you read chag? What kind of an event is this? And most every one of the invitations to meet with God is called a chag.
Yeah.
What kind of an event is it?
It's amazing some of the little things that you find because of the who is publishing the dictionaries and the lexicon and all, but they all agree on one thing. The first of all is it's a feast, and it's a festive gathering.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you'll find that it's a celebration by dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go to the King James type versions of the meanings, then they add the celebration of solemnity and of sacrifice.
Yeah. By the way, let's just think. Okay, first, feast.
Uh-huh.
These are a feast for all time.
Exactly.
So a feast means that Yahweh likes eating. With a feast, you always have two things, good food and good drink.
Huh?
And there's lots of places where Yahweh speaks of good food and good drink, even in eternity. So we are going to be able in eternity to transition to a physical manifestation when we want to celebrate time, when we want to observe a moment in time and celebrate time, we're going to have a physical nature that we can transition into. Otherwise, last time I checked, light does not eat, light does not drink.
No.
So this begs the question as to what the restroom facilities are like in heaven.
Well, I'm hoping we get a pass on that.
My guess is we will. I think this is the indulgence of eating without any negative ramifications, because as you are transitioning from energy into matter, as Yosha demonstrated, you can come in any form you like, and each form can be different. You know, that's the reason why no one ever recognized him as he appeared to them transitioning from light to matter. He did. He ate fish with them. Absolutely. He had breakfast with them on his last meeting with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nature of the whole thing. So we are going to enjoy good food. Yahweh seems to like wine. So for those of us who also like wine, I think there's going to be wine consumed in eternity. Yosha made wine, so no reason to think that we will not enjoy wine and really excellent meats throughout eternity. So the first thing is, it's a feast. Now, one of the reasons it has to be a feast is when we are providing the sacrificial lamb, the Pesach lamb, Yahweh wants us to know that the lamb is there on our behalf. We're not giving it to him. And so in eternity, as we celebrate these parties, Yahweh is providing the menu. He is providing the meal that's nourishing to us. And that's really important, because he doesn't want us giving him anything. He's there to give things to us.